In the same week Apple rolls out a watch that can send your best friends your heart rate and blood pressure data while you're in the middle of your morning run, Hillary Clinton was trying to catch the world up on the forensics of her delete key. We'll talk about that in a moment. But in response to the Clinton news conference yesterday, there was another news event in the Twitter sphere. Fox News host Todd Starnes tweeted, "This is what an imploding presidential campaign looks like. Hashtag Hillary." TV's House of Cards fictional Frances Underwood got involved. Advice for Hillary Clinton, he tweeted, "Keep a phone for work and one for play. It's really not that difficult." And you might say the inventors of snarky Twitter-like headlines, the New York Post, ran this on the front page. Deleter of the free world.
I think there's this way in which the culture almost wills these moments into significance.
That's author Jacob Silverman, contributor to Slate and The Atlantic, whose new book, Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection, says the parallel universe of social media is having a growing impact on culture. The digital trail left behind by Hillary Clinton that is now a campaign issue, Silverman says, is an issue in some sense for everyone.
One thing that really interests me is what I call the culture of surveillance, about how watching one another and placing ourselves to be watched by other people is really becoming an accepted way of how we form our identities, how we communicate with other people, this notion that we're all public figures in one sort or another now. And I think that is definitely a big change versus how things might have been, say, 10 years ago.
You know, in academia, they always talk about publish or perish, that somehow you don't have an identity unless you're published. You haven't achieved seventh grade if you're not on Instagram.
Yeah, I think that's actually very apt. The way in which a lot of our social media environments are constructed, the way these platforms work, is that you have to put in some time and effort to maintain visibility. You have to publish or else you perish. So if you're not posting regularly on whether it's Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or wherever else, you kind of slip out of view. You're no longer in the news feed. There are no longer updates about you. Your identity kind of feels less than finished, perhaps, because you're not producing new material.
Is there a neutral position here? Can you be obsessively online all the time or not at all? And is that viewed as normal, or is it somehow extraordinarily abnormal to be invisible and absent?
The trend is certainly that invisibility is a strange kind of absence and abnormal almost. Someone told me this before they were going on a date, I think, that they Googled someone and the person didn't have much of a presence on the internet, it seemed like, and that was almost a red flag. And now I don't think everyone necessarily shares these opinions, but I think it's sort of understandable why someone might think that way too, because we've become habituated towards this notion that everyone sort of has a shingle that they hang online, if not quite a few, and that they maintain.
Aside from the cultural sort of parallel universe that's created by all of these social networking sites, what alarms you most about this burgeoning phenomenon?
What worries me in particular in the privacy conversation is what I sort of distinguish between two different types. There's the type of privacy in which you want to control what other people know about you. So say you're a gay kid and you haven't come out yet to your family and you live in an area where there's a fair amount of homophobia or something like that. You might worry that information you post on Facebook that you want only a small audience to see might suddenly be exposed to other people. But then there's also a different type of privacy, I think, which is less examined, which I just refer to simply as data privacy. The data that is created surrounding all of our behaviors and activities online, and it's kind of used against us in ways we don't expect.
How do the algorithms in social media customize themselves to our behavior and try to elicit more information from us? Algorithms that try to make us feel like there's some friendly character there behind the screen.
Sure. Well, I think there are a couple of different ways. I mean, the one thing you can say in general is that we have very little idea of how a lot of algorithms are involved in filtering and eliciting information from us actually work. So on Facebook, we know that the average person has over 1,000 pieces of information appearing in their Facebook news feed at any given time, or that could appear there. But Facebook doesn't want you to feel overwhelmed by everything that's being posted by everyone you follow and like and are friends with. So they're filtering it based on specific criteria that they're not really sharing with you. And we also saw, as some stories revealed over the summer, that Facebook also is in the business of testing different responses from their users. So perhaps if they think that certain information will make you feel happier or more likely to stay on the platform, which is really the main goal, is to stay on the platform for as long as possible and keep you happy and clicking, perhaps they'll start filtering out more negative news because they think you need more positive news.
How do you evaluate the "what color is this dress" moment?
Well, I think it was just sort of a lot of things landing at the right time, perhaps.
That's what all these are. This viralness is all kind of little perfect storms.
Right, right. And I think there's also a genuine sense in which people want that perfect storm. You know, to me, there wasn't anything necessarily about that particular phenomenon. The people who are online and connected and plugged into this kind of thing, there is this almost shared sense that we want this to be an obsession. We want this to be what everyone's fixating on all of a sudden. I mean, we used to get this kind of feeling when a disaster happened and all the TV news channels cut in, say, sorry to interrupt regular programming, there's been an accident or something like that. But now you can kind of have that collective feeling of shared attention, of shared value, that something is really important, matters quite a bit, about things that might be interesting but are also frequently meaningless.
Jacob Silverman is the author of Terms of Service, Social Media, and the Price of Constant Connection. Jacob, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.